headlines this hour. Iran's president says events in Afghanistan in the past two decades are a clear manifestation of aggression and human rights violation. The Russian president, Vladimir Putin, says that the United States' 20-year campaign in Afghanistan had zero results and ended in, quote, only tragedies, only losses. Also coming up, the Palestinian Health Ministry says that Israeli troops shot and killed a Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says that events that unfolded in Afghanistan during the past two decades serve as a concrete manifestation of aggression and human rights violations there. Raisi said, to grasp an idea of the situation in Afghanistan, one needs to look at the number of civilians, including women and children, killed or injured since the U.S. invasion of the country. The Iranian president underlined that the impoverished nation has witnessed, quote, a silent catastrophe while under the U.S. occupation. Raisi said the history of the U.S. military presence in other countries also shows that they not only failed to boost security, but undermined prevailing calm and stability. The president said Americans who should be answerable to their dismissal rights record to the public are just searching for pretexts to tarnish images of other countries over human rights. The Russian president Vladimir Putin says 20 years of U.S. presence in Afghanistan has ended in, quote, only tragedies, only losses. Putin was addressing students in the Russian city of Vladivostok. He said that the U.S. Army tried to impose their norms in Afghanistan for two decades. However, he added that it was a futile practice that resulted in the losses for Americans and more for the Afghan people. The Russian president stressed that it is impossible to impose anything on a nation from the outside. He also criticized Western countries' efforts to place Afghan refugees in Central Asian states. Russia argues that militants could enter the region under the guise of refugees. Political commentator Greg Simmons says that the U.S. and its allies failed to impose the Western form of democracy on the Afghan nation through military means.
Many Western politicians and commentators are less willing to make this idea that by spreading democracy and these kinds of things by military means, it's quite Orwellian, and it sort of underlies the failure of the whole system, because it's forcing, coercing a people, a country, to accept values and norms which are completely alien to them at the barrel of a gun. If you look, the same people in charge that have been doing these for years, including Joe Biden himself. I mean, he's had a solid history of voting for U.S. wars of aggression. So I think this is not a radical changing of their stance and their attitude, but rather a rebalancing, because the U.S. is a waning force in the globe. So they need to prioritize where they put those financial, military, and political resources, because they don't have as much as they had previously.
Qatar has urged the Taliban to ensure safe passage of those Afghans who want to leave the country after the end of evacuations of American and other foreign forces there.
We stress on the Taliban the issue of freedom of movement, that there be safe passage for people to leave and enter if they want. We hope to see these commitments fulfilled in the near future, when the airport begins operations again, and that it happens smoothly, and that there be no obstacles for anyone wanting to leave or come to Afghanistan.
The Qatari foreign minister made the remarks in a joint press conference with his visiting Dutch counterpart. More than 123,000 foreign nationals and Afghans were evacuated from Afghanistan in a frenzied airlift operation to meet the August 31st deadline, but many more Afghans are desperate to depart. U.S. officials have said the Kabul airport is in a bad condition, with much of its basic infrastructure degraded or destroyed. Qatar hosted negotiations between the Taliban and the U.S. in recent years and was a transit point for about 43,000 evacuees from Afghanistan. The German foreign minister has met the Pakistani officials in Islamabad to discuss the situation in Afghanistan. The visit of Haiku Maas came hours after the U.S. led foreign forces ended their 20-year war in Afghanistan. Kamran Yusuf has the details.
The German foreign minister is the first top diplomat from a European country to visit Islamabad after Kabul fell to the Taliban. Haiku Maas arrived in the Pakistani capital hours after the U.S. forces ended their 20-year war in Afghanistan. The situation in the war-torn country was the main talking point during talks between the German and Pakistani foreign ministers. Pakistan, that shares a 2,600-kilometer-long border with Afghanistan, is concerned about the further instability in its neighboring country. The Pakistani foreign minister has this message for the world to avert yet another crisis in Afghanistan.
This is a pivotal moment in Afghanistan's history. The international community must remain engaged. Humanitarian assistance must flow. Do not let the economic collapse in Afghanistan take place.
But the German foreign minister linked the future cooperation with the Taliban living up to the promises they have made with the international community.
It is important for us that all Afghans, even those who do not support the Taliban, feel represented by this government, and it remains to be seen whether the Taliban take this into account.
Germany was part of the US-led alliance in Afghanistan, and hence the German foreign minister was asked what lessons the West should learn from their defeat in Afghanistan.
During the press conference, the German foreign minister conceded that the experiment to impose a specific form of government through military intervention was unsuccessful in Afghanistan. For him, the lesson for the West is that military intervention is not suited if it is meant for exporting and imposing a certain system on the foreign soil.
As the US finally ended its military campaign in Afghanistan, there are questions now about the future of Afghanistan. The Taliban may be celebrating the victory over the US, but their real test has only begun. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
The Taliban have called on their opposition group in the Panjshir Valley to lay down their arms as fighting continues over the control of the mountainous terrain. A senior Taliban official asked the people of Panjshir to stop their resistance, adding that the area has been surrounded by Taliban forces. He also said that the group has tried to negotiate for peace, but to no avail. Former Defense Minister Bismillah Mohammadi said that the Taliban had launched a renewed offensive on Tuesday night, but were forced to retreat with heavy casualties. People in Panjshir continue to defy the Taliban's calls for surrender.
I with the Taliban, they should put their weapons down. War, occupation, force were never a solution for this country and never will be. In case they want to enter Panjshir with force, they will take this pipe dream to their graves.
We are from the Popular People's Movement. Our message to the Taliban is that the gates of peace are open to them. Our gates are open to the Taliban for peace. If they make peace with us, we have no problems with any of them. If God forbid they attack Panjshir, each and every one of us from Panjshir will defend all of Afghanistan. We defended it during the era of the Russians, the era of the British, the previous era of the Taliban. We will defend all of Afghanistan and will continue to defend it.
The National Resistance Front in Panjshir is leading the fight against the Taliban. It consists of militiamen and former Afghan security forces. The group is headed by Ahmad Massoud, son of the late anti-Soviet Mujahideen commander Ahmad Shah Massoud. Panjshir has a long history of resistance. The region neither fell to the Soviets during the 1980s nor to the Taliban during their previous rule. The Iranian army has unveiled dozens of domestically manufactured military equipment. Authorities say that the move is aimed at boosting Iran's capability in electronic defense. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Meet Alborz, Iran's latest long-range radar that can detect any hostile aerial object in any given altitude. The Iranian domestically developed radar can track 300 targets at the same time, within a range of 450 kilometers. The high-tech equipment was unveiled on the occasion of the National Air Defense Day.
Alborz radar system is produced by our experts in Iran. It is capable of tracking any air target in high, medium, and low altitudes. Nothing can escape from this powerful radar, and even radar-evading aircrafts would be caught in the net of this advanced new radar.
Alborz radar was unveiled along with over 80 other indigenously built military hardware. Iran says the new equipment will significantly boost Iran's capability in electronic defense. And this, they say, was achieved despite all-out sanctions imposed by the U.S. against Iran's defense sector.
Despite all the restrictions and sanctions imposed on our country over the past four decades, we have managed to turn the threats into opportunities and build up our own arms arsenal. And the wide range of military hardware that you witnessed today are a result of the pressures imposed on us by our enemies.
The National Air Defense Day marks the formation of the Islamic Republic of Iran's air defense as a separate force in 2008, when it split from the country's air force. The military force says it possesses all the essential arms needed to defend Iran's skies, and 100% of the equipment, they say, are made indigenously.
Iran's air defense says the country's skies are safer than ever with its homegrown military equipment. Officials here say they owe this to four decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes that have prompted Iran to stand on its own feet and become self-sufficient in the defense industry. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Israeli troops have shot dead a Palestinian in the occupied West Bank overnight. The Palestinian Health Ministry has confirmed the deadly shooting without providing further details. The victim is reportedly a 39-year-old man who lived in a village near the city of Ramallah. Villagers say that there were disturbances or clashes in the area at the time of the shooting. They say that the slain Palestinian was returning from work when Israelis shot and killed him. Mona Kandil says Israeli forces killed the man as he was passing through a checkpoint.
The Palestinian mortar had a Jerusalem Al-Quds documents, because Palestinians who are originally from Al-Quds hold Jerusalem IDs, Israeli-issued IDs, so he has the right to move freely from the villages and from the occupied West Bank to the lands that were occupied in 1948, Al-Quds, as well as inside Israel. However, the Israeli forces were standing at the checkpoint, and then they opened fire when they saw him entering from the western entrance of the village of Beit Aur al-Tahta. Palestinians condemned the killing of this Palestinian man in cold blood. Hamas movement issued a statement calling for the Palestinians not to stop the different forms of resistance, saying that Palestinians will continue their struggle against the Israeli occupation.
The third wave of coronavirus is surging through the Gaza Strip. Daily COVID-19 infections have been rising over the past few days. The impoverished enclave lacks many resources to combat the coronavirus pandemic due to the crippling Israeli blockade in place since 2007. Rashav Shannon has more details.
The Gaza Strip has entered a third COVID wave, with over 1,300 new infections being discovered daily. Infections include the extremely dangerous Delta variant. People in the blockaded enclave are flocking to vaccination centers every day to get their coronavirus shots. The recent surge in infections and death is threatening to overwhelm hospitals weakened by years of Israeli blockade and wars. On Tuesday, over 30,000 Gazans received their COVID-19 vaccinations.
Initially, we didn't have vaccines, and soon after they arrived in the Gaza Strip, people, including myself, were afraid to get the vaccination jab. I now believe that the vaccines are safe and everyone must get inoculated in order to protect themselves and protect their families.
COVID-19 has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the impoverished coastal sliver, threatening the socioeconomic welfare of people in Gaza as much as their health.
Everyone must get the vaccine because this pandemic is deadly and has taken its toll on all humanity. I call on everyone to receive the vaccination jabs for the sake of their families.
Currently, there are some 12,000 active coronavirus cases in the Gaza Strip. UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, has played a major role in providing the blockaded enclave with badly needed coronavirus vaccines.
UNICEF has been providing vaccinations to the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and we work with the Ministry of Health and other organizations to help reach herd immunity. Over the past few days, we were able to vaccinate some 95,000 people in Gaza, which is a great achievement.
The weakness of the healthcare system makes Gaza's population highly vulnerable to further major outbreaks of the deadly pandemic.
Rights groups say Israel's illegal practices continue to compound the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the blockaded coastal strip. The measures, they say, are making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly virus. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
French President Emmanuel Macron has once again caused deep offense after attacking Islam on social media. Following a weekend tour of Iraq, Macron conflated Islam with the Daesh while simultaneously stealing full credit for the group's defeat. Rob Carter reports from London.
French President Emmanuel Macron has again caused serious offense to Muslims over the weekend by issuing controversial remarks conflating Islam to extremism and the terrorist actions of notorious Takfiri group Daesh. The comments published during a state visit to Iraq claimed that even though France defeated Daesh, the battle against Islamic terrorism isn't over.
He just can't seem to help himself. Even during a trip which was meant to smooth over damaged relations between France and the Muslim world, Macron again attacked the very religion which its adherents both played the biggest role in defeating the terrorist organization, but also suffered the most at its hands.
Robert Carter, London.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The U.S. Education Department has initiated investigations into five states whose prohibitions on universal mask mandates in schools may run afoul of civil rights laws protecting students with disabilities. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Erica Green and Daniel Slotnick. The piece is titled "The U.S. Education Department is investigating five states over their mask mandate bans." The Education Department has initiated investigations into five states whose prohibitions on universal mask mandates in schools may run afoul of civil rights laws protecting students with disabilities. federal officials announced on Monday. The department's civil rights head wrote to state education leaders in Iowa, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Utah, notifying them that the department's Office for Civil Rights would determine whether the prohibitions are restricting access for students who are protected under federal law from discrimination based on their disabilities and are entitled to a free, appropriate public education. The investigations made good on the Biden administration's promise to use the federal government's muscle, including civil rights investigations and legal action, to intervene in states where governors and other policymakers have come out against mask mandates in public schools. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, recommends that everyone in schools should wear face masks regardless of vaccination status. In the letters to state leaders, the acting Assistant Secretary of Civil Rights said the department would explore whether the prohibitions may be preventing schools from meeting their legal obligations not to discriminate based on disability and from providing an equal educational opportunity to students with disabilities who are at heightened risk of severe illness from COVID-19. The department said it has not opened investigations in Florida, Texas, Arkansas, or Arizona because those states' bans on wearing face masks in schools are not being enforced in schools because of litigation or other state action. Sydney Dixon, Utah Superintendent of Public Instruction, said in a statement on Monday that while she appreciated the federal department's efforts to protect children, she believed they have unfairly defined Utah as a state where mask mandates cannot occur. She said that the state's law left the decision up to local officials and that several counties had implemented them. She noted that the CDC, back in March, studied a Utah district as an example of how elementary schools had reopened without significant outbreaks. Oklahoma and South Carolina education officials signaled that they opposed their state's prohibitions on mask mandates. Joy Hoffmeister, Oklahoma's superintendent of public instruction, said in a statement that the State Department of Education planned to cooperate with the investigation. Oklahoma's law against mask mandates is preventing schools from fulfilling their legal duty to protect and provide all students the opportunity to learn more safely in person, she said. In a statement, the South Carolina Department of Education said that the state superintendent had repeatedly implored the legislature to reconsider a recently passed proviso on mask mandates, which it said was being challenged in courts of law. The department said it is particularly sensitive to the law's effect on South Carolina's most vulnerable students. Brian Symes, the communications director for Governor Henry McMaster of South Carolina, wrote in a statement that the federal investigation by the Education Department was another attempt by the Biden administration to force a radical liberal agenda on states and people who disagree with them. He added, under South Carolina law, anybody who wants to wear a face mask in a school setting or elsewhere is free to do so, but the governor isn't going to ignore a parent's fundamental right to make health decisions for their children. Officials in the Education Department of Iowa and Tennessee acknowledged they'd received and were reviewing their letters. Earlier this month, President Biden announced he had directed his Education Secretary, Miguel Cardona, to use the agency's broad powers to intervene in states where governors had blocked wearing of face masks in schools. Dr. Miguel Cardona has said he is particularly perturbed by prohibitions in places where the Delta variant of the coronavirus has sent cases surging. He said he has heard from desperate parents who fear sending their immunocompromised and medically vulnerable children into schools that do not have universal masking.
dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And our guest speaker, as always, Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program again.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Well, the concept and the topic that we are going to delve into related to the Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Sistani is mourning. And that is the mourning for Imam Hussein and Muharram. And this is actually a good platform for me and the whole crew here from the IRIB English Radio to express our condolences to everybody who's listening to us, to our dear audiences. And inshallah, we hope that this program would come to good use. Let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani, and then we'll be back.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about the laws related to mourning, in fact, to commemorate Imam Hussein's martyrdom anniversary during Muharram. According to the laws issued or fatwas issued by Ayatollah Sistani, let me ask you this question. What is the Islamic law about beating drums during Muharram?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, beating drums is common in some Muslim countries on the day of Ashura, especially in Iran, of course. Mourners come with their drums and they start beating drums, of course. As far as I know, none of the religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Sistani, are opposed to beating drums. So beating drums is permissible in and of itself, provided that, of course, it is confined to beating drums, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, people do not go overboard using other, let's say, musical instruments, playing music, because music is one thing, beating drum is another thing, okay? Mm-hmm. Beating drums even was common in the early period of Islam. They used to beat drums, okay?
Yes.
And of course it has a philosophy, a concept, which we need to understand as to why beating drums is allowed. Of course, in the early period of Islam, when Muslims were going to war against, for example, a group of, let's say, non-Muslims or opponents, mm-hmm. let's say, they used to beat drums to, let's say, to scare them.
Yes, especially in wars.
Yeah, beating wars.
Yes.
But in this time around, of course, beating drums is allowed because it's also recognized as a means or as a tool for commemorating the event of Ashura.
Yes.
And of course, there's no objection to it.
I see. You also hinted at the other musical instruments. You said if they don't go overboard to play other musical instruments, what about flute or trumpet? These are also the instruments which are used in some of these mourning processions.
Of course, Ayatollah Sistani is strongly opposed to using flute and trumpet. Only drum is allowed. No other musical instruments, because when musical instruments are played, okay, flute is also a kind of musical instrument, okay?
Yes.
Because you can play with flute different, let's say, you can just use the flute to create different kinds of sounds, okay? Yes. Some of the sounds may not be appealing and may not be considered appropriate. So,
but it's not a happy sound or music coming out of flute.
Yeah,
flute is usually, like by nature, it's very sad.
It's not sad. It can be very happy as well. You know, it's only in some countries where flute is used for sad, for creating sad sounds.
Mm-hmm.
But flute can also be used to create very happy sounds. So therefore, since it's it can be misused mm-hmm. by people, and when if permission is given, then it will know no bound. Okay, people will go overboard; they will go to extremes using flute and other musical instruments. Therefore, it's not permissible, according to Ayatollah Sistani, to play musical instruments whatsoever.
I see. Okay, let's take a very short break and we'll be back continuing our discussion on the laws related to mourning during Muharram according to Ayatollah Sistani. Sure. Stay with us.
I walk in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you, who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces, who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing in my veins, who are you? To me, desire, desire, dreams are more. Desire, desire, dreams, desire.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the laws according to Ayatollah Sistani about mourning and lamentation for Imam Hussein's martyrdom during Muharram. Sheikh Javid, what is the Islamic law about wedding or nikah in the month of Muharram and Safar?
Well, nikah itself or per se is permissible because it's highly recommended to get married. And there are some people who are under the impression that nikah is not allowed, okay? Because they think nikah means happiness. Nikah is coupled with music. Nikah is coupled or twixt with something which is forbidden. Well, nikah can be without music, nikah can be without anything like that. So nikah is to make two persons, two individuals halal for each other.
Yes.
And it's a permissible act. It is even recommended, and according to the religion, it is half of iman, okay?
Yes.
And a person who gets married has actually completed half of his faith and half of his iman, and he should observe piety for the other half.
Mm-hmm.
Observe piety, God consciousness for the other half.
Yes.
So there is no problem in having your nikah done on the day of Ashura, even on the day of Ashura, okay?
Yes.
But we should understand that wedding is not allowed. Wedding means calling people and giving them a feast and then celebrating and wearing new clothes, because this is what we understand from wedding, okay?
Yes.
Of course, it's not permissible because it amounts to disrespect. It's a kind of disregard to Muharram, and mm-hmm. we have to respect Muharram. Just as I said, the concept of Muharram is to respect those symbols and remember the suffering of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We cannot remember the suffering of Imam Hussein and his companions by having your celebration which goes against the whole yes. concept.
Exactly.
So it's not permissible. Wedding is not allowed, but yes. nikah is permissible.
By nikah, you mean the day or the time when the marriage formula is pronounced.
It's pronounced.
Not the wedding ceremony.
Not the wedding ceremony.
Yes.
Okay. That's what nikah means, marriage contract.
Yes.
Which can be concluded or solemnized on the day of Ashura.
Okay. And the other question, Sheikh Javed, is it permissible for a man to take part in a procession or a mourning ceremony where you cannot avoid coming in contact with women? In other words, your body touches their body, and that is something that happens without you having it under control.
Well, that's also a good question. You know that on the day of, let's say, Ashura, people do come out into the streets. If a person doesn't know and does not have such an intention
mm-hmm.
to make his body touch the body of a non-mahram, okay, there's no problem coming into the streets. And because we do know that women are there, men are there, and all of them can come out into the streets and actually mourn for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. But if one knows that if he goes into the crowd,
mm-hmm.
his body will come in contact with the body of a woman, and he will end up touching a woman, it's not permissible. No, none of the religious authorities actually allows coming in contact with a non-mahram, okay?
Yes.
Allowing your body to touch the body of a woman is not permissible, and if one knows that it's going to happen, it's not permissible. Not even if it's not intentional, because when you know that such a thing will happen, it's not permissible to go in and let your body touch the body of a non-mahram woman.
Yes, and it doesn't matter whether it is indoor or outdoor, because some of the groups of procession you can see in some areas around the mosque, or
yeah.
even in some of the areas related to or affiliated with the shrines.
Yes.
You know, it happens so that or such that some of these mourning groups, in fact, enter and come out of those places. So it would be very much, hectic and busy in those and crowded in those areas. So... Yeah. It's not permissible to go in that area?
When you know that you will end up touching a non-mahram woman, of course, it's not permissible. Generally speaking, mixed gatherings are not encouraged at all.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is on the day of Ashura for mourning the suffering of Imam Hussein, or it is a wedding, mixed gatherings are not allowed when it leads to such sins.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much, Javed. Once again, I use this opportunity to express our heartfelt condolences to our dear audiences, and may God accept all of our mourning and azadari for Imam Hussein and their pure household. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new land.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
For two decades, Americans have told each other one lie after another about the war in Afghanistan. The lies have come from the White House, Congress, the State Department, the Pentagon, and the CIA, as well as from Hollywood, cable news pundits, journalists, and the broader culture, says James Risen, writer, in an article titled, For two decades, Americans told one lie after another about what they were doing in Afghanistan. Stay tuned, please, for the first part of this article. For two decades, Americans have told each other one lie after another about the war in Afghanistan. The lies have come from the White House, Congress, the State Department, the Pentagon, and the CIA, as well as from Hollywood, cable news pundits, journalists, and the broader culture. Americans have hungered for a simple storyline, with heroes and villains, to make sense of the longest war in the United States history. They have wanted stories like 12 Strong to make them feel good. But at the very edge of the American empire, the war was nasty and brutish and brought out in Americans the same imperial arrogance that doomed the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. This month, as the Taliban swiftly take control of Kabul and the American-backed government collapse, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, the government's watchdog over the Afghan experience, issued his final report. The assessment includes remarkably candid interviews with former American officials involved in shaping U.S. policy in Afghanistan that collectively offer perhaps the most biting critique of the 20-year American enterprise ever published in an official U.S. government report. The extraordinary costs were meant to serve a purpose, the report notes, though the definition of that purpose evolved over time. Released in the days after Kabul fell, the report reads like an epitaph for America's involvement in Afghanistan. One of the first things the U.S. did after gaining effective control over Afghanistan following the Taliban's ouster in 2001 was to set up secret torture chambers. Beginning in 2002, the CIA tortured both Afghans and foreign prisoners flown to these torture rooms from all over Central Asia, Africa, the West Asia, North Africa region. The worst torture chamber was nicknamed the Darkness by the prisoners sent there who suffered such complete sensory deprivation that they did not even know they were in Afghanistan. They were chained in solitary confinement with no light and music blaring constantly. They were hung by their arms for as long as 2 days, slammed against walls, forced to lie naked on traps, while gallons of ice water were poured over their bodies. At least one prisoner died in CIA custody after being left shackled in frigid temperatures. No one was ever held to account for the American torture regime in Afghanistan. American drone strikes also started early in Afghanistan. The CIA killed Al-Qaeda operative Mohammad Atef and others with a drone there in November 2001, just 2 months after 9/11. Afghanistan soon became the beta test site for high-tech drone warfare, leading to countless civilian casualties and deep resentment among the Afghan people, who felt helpless against the unseen threats circling overhead. America's early adoption of drone warfare in Afghanistan helped make a fortune for Neil Blue, the chair of General Atomics. The Southern California Energy and Defense Corporation manufactured the Predator, the first armed drone to fly over Afghanistan. General Atomics subsequently produced the Predator's follow-on model, the Reaper. Blue and his brother, Lyndon Blue, vice chair of General Atomics, maintained low public profiles throughout the war. But as owners of privately held General Atomics, they were among the first but hardly the last American contractors to enrich themselves as blood spilled in Afghanistan. Before long, the CIA's drone campaign shifted from going after the few Al-Qaeda operatives it could find in Afghanistan to targeting the Taliban, thus placing the drone campaign squarely in the midst of Afghan domestic insurgency. The U.S. launched more than 13,000 drone strikes in Afghanistan between 2015 and 2020, killing up to 10,000 people, according to statistics kept by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. The CIA, relying on cell phone numbers to find, fix, and finish its alleged enemies, often launched its Hellfire missiles at the wrong targets or at targets standing amid groups of civilians. The practice devastated Afghan villages. Yet the United States regime refused to keep track of civilian casualties from drone strikes. Instead, officials insisted that each strike had hit its intended target, while ignoring the claims of villagers that the missiles had killed a tribal chief or decimated a meeting of village elders. Along with drone strikes came night raids, in which U.S. forces would burst into a home in the middle of the night and kill or capture those inside, breeding further resentment. The raids were so deeply unpopular that they sometimes led an entire village to switch its allegiance to the Taliban. That was worse. The U.S. military and the CIA failed for years to fully grasp the degree to which their airstrikes and night raids were being manipulated by Afghans who fed them false information to convince the Americans to launch raids against their local rivals or have those rivals carted off to Guantanamo. The The shift of American resources by the Bush administration to Iraq in 2002 and 2003 was the greatest military miscalculation of the entire war in Afghanistan. While the United States was distracted by Iraq, the Taliban, which had been all but defeated and dispersed, recovered and regained the strength. Yet, even as the Bush administration drew down militarily in Afghanistan, it is still insisted on creating a new pro-Western government in Kabul and began a massive nation-building project in the country. It did so without grasping the significance of several basic facts about conditions it faced. As the Taliban revived, the Bush administration had few troops left in Afghanistan to counter the threat. Within a few years of its initial victory in 2001, the United States regime was stuck in a quagmire of its own making in Afghanistan, just as it did was in Iraq. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM. 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. Many of us, rather all of us, should rather hope, or rather we had wished and we pray that, you know, we are with the Imam of our time and we are, you know, of those who support him and who attain the reward of martyrdom and the station of a martyr with the Imam alayhi salam. But also many of us, again, all of us should hope and pray and wish that we are with Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, for on that day we would have attained a great reward. And this is where that particular phrase comes from. It is reported from Imam Ridha alayhi salam to one of his companions. And Imam alayhi salam says that if you desire that you attain or gain the reward equivalent to that of those martyred along with Hussein alayhi salam. Now obviously there is two things, there is one important thing that we need to remember here. That attaining an equivalent reward does not mean you attain an equivalent state and station. There's two very different things. For what they did and what we do, you know, are vastly different. Now may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make us of the true assisters of the Imam, inshaAllah. So the Imam continues, said, if you wish to attain a reward equivalent to that of those martyred along with Hussein alayhi salam, then whenever you remember him, that is whenever you remember Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala, you should recite this, that Ya laytani kuntu ma'ahum fa'afuzu fawdan azeema. That if only that I would have been with them, which is true, I would have achieved a great reward. I would have achieved a great victory if only I was with them. But obviously, as we mentioned previously, that just because we mentioned this, just because, you know, we try to attain that reward that the Shuhada of Karbala attained, it is not something that it's easy to, you know, keep hold of. For they attained a station, they were not looking for reward. Their reward was the Imam himself. Their reward was the sacrifice itself. The reward was not the thawab or paradise or anything like that. No, these are all secondary things. Us, unfortunately, we are the opposite. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to truly see the reward being the companionship of the Imam alayhi salam, and to assist us in doing so. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The spotlight.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.